Let's take a journey back to 2003. Canadian teen sensation Avril Lavigne was topping the charts and turning the music industry upside down. But what if I told you that the Avril Lavigne we know and love might not be the same Avril? What? Did Avril die? Was she replaced by a doppelganger? I'm Joanne McNally, and I'm doing a deep dive into a notorious internet conspiracy. Who replaced Avril Lavigne? Listen wherever you get your podcasts.
This is a CBC podcast.
So back in the olden days when everyone seemed to have a BlackBerry, Glenn Howerton didn't. It wasn't that he was a Luddite, it was just that he didn't want to be contacted all the time, which in retrospect he was right about. So now flash forward a few years, Glenn is starring in the new movie all about the rise and fall of BlackBerry. He was actually here about 3 hours before he was about to meet in real life the guy he plays in the film, Jim Balsillie. You'll hear how he was feeling leading up to that moment. Glenn Howerton coming up. Plus, the story of two boxers. One is outed as gay right before the fight. The other dies days later after being knocked out in the ring. Terrence Blanchard has taken that moment and turned it into his first opera. And he'll talk about being struck by the line, "I killed a man and the world forgave me, but I loved a man and the world wanted to kill me." That's coming up. I'm Tom Power. You're listening to Q. So yeah, at some point in your life, did you have a BlackBerry? Did you know someone who had a BlackBerry? If you're listening to the show and you found us on TikTok, if you're like, this is ancient history to you, BlackBerry was a revolutionary mobile phone. It allowed you to make calls and send texts and check emails all on the same device. It felt like everybody had one. And the actor Glenn Howerton plays Jim Balsillie, the former co-CEO of the company that brought BlackBerry to life. Glenn, you might know, also plays Dennis on the show It's Always Sunny in Philadelphia, which recently became the longest-running live-action TV comedy in U.S. history. So we talk about a lot here. We talk about why the story of BlackBerry isn't so much about tech as it is about ego, why Glenn enjoys playing characters who are narcissists, how his fighter pilot dad inspired his acting career, and how his TV show still gets away with showing bad people at their worst. But I started out by asking him back in the day whether or not he had a BlackBerry.
No, I did not have one. I very purposely never got one. Everything that everybody loved about the BlackBerry was everything that I did not want, which is to be available at all times for email, basically. Yeah. That was like my nightmare.
What did you find interesting about the whole BlackBerry story, though? If you didn't have a BlackBerry at the time, if you're sort of a resistant to that sort of technology, or you were, what did you find interesting about the story that made you get interested in it?
Well, the movies, I mean, look, for as much as it is about the rise and fall of the company BlackBerry, it's really about the characters. It's about the people who built the company. I mean, that's the most interesting thing about it is the culture that they created, the things that they did together collectively. You know, it would be easy to do a story like this and really focus on the product and the impact that the product had on the world, you know, and that's in the movie for sure. It has to be because that is an interesting part of the story. But I love that the main focus of the film is really on the people and how they built it and, you know, the chaos of building it. That's what makes the movie work for me.
What can I do for you?
Okay, picture a cell phone and an email machine all in one thing. There is a free wireless internet signal all across North America, and nobody has figured out how to use it. It's like the Force. Sorry, have you seen Star Wars?
No.
I mean, you play a pretty big figure, especially here in Canada, like a pretty household namey person here in Canada. Jim Balsillie, former co-CEO of Research in Motion, which made the BlackBerry. You know, for a while there, especially when I was like in my 20s, like this guy was in the news like every single day. Let's just start with this. Like, as an actor, what do you have to keep in mind knowing you're playing a real person, and not just a real person, but a real person who's still around?
Well, I mean, lots of conversations with the director and the producer who they wrote the film together, Matt Miller and Matt Johnson. I did my research on the man. There wasn't a tremendous amount of material out there in the public view to consume about him. Doing the research that I did and then combining that with just trusting that Matt and Matt had done all the research that, well, not just trusting, but hearing all the research that went into the script, I really put all my focus on the man that was in the script. You know, even just down to like, do you think it's important that I have a Canadian accent of some kind? You know what I mean? And he said, no, please don't, because it was interesting to us to think of Jim, and I don't know if this is true or not, but to think of Jim as the kind of person who actually went to, he did go to Harvard and purposely lost his accent.
You know
what I mean?
Because to try and fit in.
To try and seem, I don't know, like, and maybe it's the you know, Canadian underdog thing or something. But, you know, I really didn't put too much focus on trying to emulate the man.
The scene at the end when everything's kind of fallen apart. So up until then, you played Jim, man, bombastic, you know, yelling, very loud character, like takes up a lot of space.
Mike?
Hi.
There are three reasons why people buy our phones.
Do you know what they are?
Email.
They work.
Yeah, okay. It's not us, Jim. It's the carrier. Verizon is doing something weird.
Okay. Well, I'm about to do something weird if you don't fix this now.
At the end of the film, there's a really, really powerful scene where all of a sudden you're quiet. Like all of a sudden everything is crumbling around you and you, for the first time in the film, are quiet.
Mm-hmm.
Can you tell me a little bit about how you approach that scene? Do you know what I'm talking about?
Oh, yeah. No, I mean, I think you're talking about the scene after Jay's character, Mike, reveals to me that the Securities and Exchange Commission is basically next, SEC is next door waiting for me.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
He basically tells me he gave me up to the SEC in order to save himself and to save the company. We talked a lot about that scene, and up to that point, he's been literally jumping from plane to plane, like, I'm going to go here and I'm going to do this. And I say, like, earlier in the film, I'm like, I'm doing it all. I'm going to do it all. And that's my guy through the whole movie. And in that moment, I think he realizes there's nothing I can do. There's a sort of being at peace, a relinquishing of control, a sort of the relief that comes with getting caught.
I find it really curious what it feels like to play that, you know, to be that person who has no regard for consequences, is willing to crush anybody. What does it feel like when you are playing that? Like, do you get a little sense of what their life might be like?
Yeah. I mean, look, it's cathartic. It's cathartic to, I don't know, just be the bowling ball knocking over all the pins instead of being one of the pins.
Yeah.
You know, or standing on the sidelines. It's wish fulfillment. It's fun. It is a release, you know, to smash a phone. It's cathartic.
I don't, when I was doing research for this, I know I talk about this as much as you want. I'm trying to learn more about you and kind of, you know, your story there. Was your father was a fighter pilot?
Yeah. My father was in the Air Force. He was an Air Force Academy graduate. Which I don't know if you know anything about the Air Force Academy in the United States.
Not too much, no.
It's a very prestigious institution of knowledge, actually. It's like if you went to Harvard to study everything and be a genius at everything, but then also had to do a zillion push-ups and be the most physically – it's like going to, you know, Navy SEAL school and Harvard at the same time.
In highest level possible academia, highest possible level, like physical, yes, physical fitness.
The highest standard on every single level.
Wow.
It was really, really, really hardcore. Anyway, he graduated from the Air Force Academy and then immediately went to Vietnam for a year and flew something called the 01 Bird Dog, which his job was to – it's an unarmed small aircraft that would fly low, map out enemy territory, bring it back to the base, show the bombers where to drop the bombs, basically. So he was putting himself in grave, grave danger in a way that's totally different than the way, you know, they're putting themselves in danger, like in Top Gun, you know, where they're flying these awesome fast things and firing rockets and shooting guns and stuff like that. He's in an unarmed aircraft, just completely exposed by himself. And that was his experience in war. He was there for a year, and then he came back and he started flying the A-10 Warthog, which is it's called the tank destroyer because it's got this giant Gatling gun on the front that can rip a tank in half. So, and then he retired from the Air Force in his 40s and became an airline pilot with American Airlines.
Wow.
Yeah.
Well, what a life.
He just wanted to fly airplanes. That's what he realized. He was like, all that other stuff is super interesting to me. He has a master's degree in East Asian studies and all this stuff. You know, he's a really, 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 really smart guy who just likes flying airplanes.
Yeah. What an amazing life. What a thing to have your dad do. You know what I mean? Cool. Like your dad, you know.
But he's also like, you would never, you to describe him as a fighter pilot puts a very specific image in your head.
Oh, yeah. I understand now. Yeah. You know,
but he's like also the most gentle, sweet, generous person you'll ever meet.
Does that mean, so when you, he was in the military, he was in the Air Force, were you living in a lot of different places?
Yeah, moved around all my life. Yeah. Yeah. As a kid. Yeah. Mm. Yeah.
A lot of traveling.
Yeah. A lot of moving schools.
Yeah. 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 You're right. You hear about that sometimes.
Yep.
So is it oftentimes when I would hear about that, TV and film useful, in sort of mooring somebody in an unmooring situation? I guess what I'm doing is I'm wondering why you ended up acting.
Who knows, man? Like, just an insatiable desire for attention.
Like always, were you acting as a kid? Were you?
Excuse me. It all really started with me realizing I could do things to make my older sister laugh. And then that was so intoxicating, you know, because I looked up to her. She was 3.5 years older than me. So I think that was really the start of it all, was making my sister laugh and then making my parents laugh. And then realized, oh, I can make people laugh. I can entertain people. And then my parents would take us to a lot of theater. So my dad was like, even though he's an Air Force guy and a football player and all this kind of stuff, he grew up in a household. His dad was also an Air Force pilot. But before that, he was a jazz musician. And his mom is a dancer. So he grew up around the arts. So, you know, there's this weird dichotomy between like academics and arts in my, not weird, but just maybe slightly uncommon.
You would expect typically like a football, maybe this says more about me than it does about anybody else. You would expect like a football and military family to not be the family that has a jazz musician in it or a dancer, or would be cool with like a kid going into the arts.
Dad was playing football at the Air Force Academy, flying, you know, fighter jets or fighter planes and taking us to theater.
Cool.
And dance concerts and things like that when we were growing up. So I would watch the actors on stage when we were in England. I remember a very small kid go see, you know, Shakespeare at Stratford-upon-Avon, and I wanted to be on that stage so bad. At the time, of course, I just thought like, well, yeah, who wouldn't? Everybody in the audience wants to be on stage. Of course they do.
Yeah. But
they don't.
Yeah.
That was just me and maybe one other kid.
Yeah.
And most people are like, I definitely don't want to do that.
Yeah.
You know,
that's terrifying.
Terrifying.
To me. Yeah.
But I feel completely comfortable and at home on stage. More comfortable almost than anywhere else.
I'm Tom Power. Glenn Howerton is my guest. He's been talking about playing Jim Balsillie, the bombastic CEO of Research in Motion, which is the company, the Canadian company, by the way, that brought the BlackBerry to life. We've also been talking about why he became an actor, about how he grew up with a fighter pilot dad who really valued both art and academia. So if you don't know Glenn by name, you might know him from his show, It's Always Sunny in Philadelphia, a show that he created with two of his buddies. It's about this really despicable group of friends, really kind of bad people. The show's been on TV for 18 years. It has a massive following. And while he was here, I wanted to ask him about how that show got started. I was a really big fan I'm still a really big fan, but I was a fan when, and this is wrong to say to you, I was a fan when you couldn't watch it in Canada. We had to pirate it.
I've had a lot of people in Canada tell me that.
Yeah. I mean, like I would go on like LimeWire because I would hear about it like through the internet that there was this show in America that was really funny.
Yeah.
So I would, you know, go on and.
That's cool, man. I mean, I like that, that there are so many people who were at least hearing about it. You're like, you got to see this, and then we're making it. I mean, look, that all pays off in the end, right? You could LimeWire it, but now you get it and you consume it the right way, and you know, it all works out in the wash. But if you'd not gotten addicted to it when you were watching it on LimeWire, you may not be watching it now. So,
but I remember watching. I think it was like a tape, Glenn, like a tape.
You saw the whole movie?
Yeah. So can you tell me the story? It was like you and Rob and Charlie.
Uh-huh. We had been shooting things together for a little while, just experimenting with stuff, just shooting things on our own camera. And then Rob came to me one day with a scene. He was like, I had this idea. I wanted to try to make a scene about cancer funny.
Yeah.
And I was like, okay, you have my attention. And so he sort of told me about the scene and he handed me like this little script. And he was like, I want you and Charlie to act in this scene together.
Jesus, dude, I thought my place looked like shit.
Oh, yeah, sorry.
Did you have a party or something? I mean, you seem like you're a little hungover.
No, it's I found out that I might have cancer.
What?
Yeah, I found out a couple weeks ago that I might have cancer. That's why I've been kind of holed up in here. I haven't been going to auditions. I haven't even told anybody.
You haven't told anybody that you have cancer?
That I might have cancer, Glenn. I don't know yet that I have cancer.
We shot the scene. We had such a blast doing it that we built sort of a whole story around it. But it was more of like just a short film. And we were literally just doing it for fun. Just to show our friends, like, we think this is funny.
Yeah.
We'll shoot this stupid thing because what else we're doing? We got all kinds of time on our hands. And then we realized, like, this is really funny, but it's not good enough. So we scrapped it and we shot it again. And then we had so much fun doing that that we were like, you know what? This doesn't feel like a short film. It feels like a TV show. Let's shoot a second episode, you know? So we shot a second episode of it.
Out of your own pocket, just for fun, like using.
Yeah, well, when I say shot it on our own, I mean open the blinds, turn on a lamp, put a mic on a broomstick, literally.
Yeah,
which is what we did.
Yeah,
and all of our friends be camera operators and boom operators, and that's what we did. And then we showed it to our manager. One of the reasons we knew each other is we all were represented by the same company, 3 Arts Entertainment. We showed it to them. They thought it was funny. And the rest is history.
I mean, I think it's the longest running live action comedy ever.
In American television history, certainly. There may be longer runs in other countries, but yeah.
Why do you think it's lasted that long? A big question, I know, but.
I think that people are desperate, especially now more than ever, always, but desperate now more than ever for satire.
Yeah.
To see the unspeakable portrayed on screen in a way that's good-natured, coming from people that that are actually good people, that are actually satirizing it in a way where you understand that they're not condoning the behavior, they're just satirizing it, you know. And I think there's a large segment of the population who is not being served now because we're so afraid to say and do the wrong thing for fear of getting canceled or whatever. I think it's a little bit of wish fulfillment. I think you want to see people acting badly because you have, but it only works if we've done our job right as writers. That bad behavior is coming from an impulse that a lot of people share, that our audience shares. They're like, ooh, I've wanted to do that before, but I would never because I'm not a bad person.
Yeah.
But you get to watch other people do it on TV.
Yeah.
You get the wish fulfillment of watching them do the bad thing, the awful thing. But then you also get brought reminded at the end of why you don't do that, because there's consequences.
Yeah.
And it's ultimately not the right thing to do, but you still get the catharsis of watching somebody else do it.
I swear you would be of more use to me if I skinned you and turned your skin into a lampshade, or fashioned you into a piece of high-end luggage. I can even add you to my collection.
Are you saying that you have a collection of skin luggage?
Of course I'm not, Dee. Don't be ridiculous. Think of the smell. Now you say another word, and I swear to God I will dice you into a million little pieces and put those pieces in a box that I will display on my mantle. All right. Now that that's settled, we can have a normal conversation.
We need to be able to portray awful people doing awful things. You know, Charlie said an interesting thing. He's like, God, if we get to a point in our society where we can't have bad characters doing bad things.
Yeah.
We're screwed.
Yeah.
You know, it needs to be done thoughtfully.
Yeah.
And we certainly don't always get it right. And I don't claim that we do, but we've got to try. My God, we've got to try.
But you can kind of tell the motivations, Glenn. Like, that's what I can kind of tell. Yeah. I can tell the motivation is to do it the right way. You know what I mean? Like, you're trying to do it the right way.
We're coming from a good place.
Yeah. So there's like two sides to that. One is like, hey, great. How often does an actor get to work on something for 20 years? Very rarely. How often does an actor get to have steady employment for 20 years? Very rarely.
Yeah.
On the other side of things, what's it like to do the same character for 20 years?
it's amazing. It really is. It's been what an incredible gift to get to develop a character over the course of 20 years. And it has, by the way, been 20 years since we shot the first Home movie.
Wild.
Interesting that you bring that up, the 20 years, because we shot the original Home movie in the fall of 2003. So it's incredible. It's incredible. There have been certainly times where I'm like, I can't do this anymore.
Yeah, you left for like, I think a little while.
I tried to leave.
Yeah.
Pulled me back in.
I remember those episodes. I remember that. Yeah. Well, I think you've talked about that enough, but let me ask you this. When you came back to it, did you see something about the show that maybe you didn't see before you left?
No. No, I never lost touch with how I feel about the show, my gratitude for the show, what an incredibly unique situation that we're in to be able to even make the show. You know, I got to a point where I was feeling a little hemmed in and just feeling like I wanted to express myself in different ways, doing different things, and I felt like I didn't have the space in my brain and my body to do it. Some people have boundless amounts of energy. I would actually put Rob and Charlie in that category. Like, those guys have always had the ability to do It's Always Sunny and also still do a million other things.
Start a football team and make a documentary about a football team.
Yeah.
You know, these things.
Yeah. That's Rob. Yeah. Rob. He has the ability and the energy to do that. Me, I don't. I'm not a good multitasker.
Yeah.
I'm not a good multitasker. I need to do one thing, do it really, really well, and then I need to go to sleep.
Let me close off like this. So, like, one thing that does that does afford you is the ability to not have to. I don't know if I mean like you don't have to. I mean, I don't know. Like, maybe you just don't have to do things you don't want to do as much when you get to this part of your career. You know, things have been going well for a really, really long time. I really love the BlackBerry film. I thought you were really great in it. I really love that you went for it and like shaved your head for it, which is wild. What does a project at this stage of your career need to have for you to do it?
I want to have fun.
Yeah. This seemed like fun.
It was. And it's hard work. It's hard work. But the two aren't necessarily separate things. It can be fun and hard work at the same time. I just don't really want to work on something that's just hard and not fun.
Yeah.
Even if it's good.
Yeah.
I'm like, I don't know, man. I just don't know if I have it in me to do something that's not fun to work on.
I mean, why would you if you don't have to, right?
Yeah. Exactly. Well, you do it because you have other external validation that you're looking for. You know, you're just like, oh, this is going to suck, but I could win an Oscar.
Yeah. it's a great story. It's blowing my mind still that like, this is a great story. I think Canadians are really going to get a kick out of it because, I mean, it's great to see this kind of story that we were all sort of raised with and we all kind of know. But also, I can't get over what you said to me earlier that, like, yeah, I think a lot of people are about to do, like, yeah, I think I remember Obama having a BlackBerry and just watching them figure out the story. Congratulations on the film. Thanks for coming in.
Thank you so much. I really appreciate you having me.
Glenn Howerton was my guest. He stars in the new film BlackBerry. That's in theaters May 12th, and it's coming to CBC in the fall. All right, coming up on the show, the story of two boxers who were once friends. One outs the other as gay during the pre-match press conference, is knocked out in the ring the next day, and dies in the hospital days later. How did that story end up becoming the most talked about opera of the year? You'll hear from its creator, Terrence Blanchard, after this. I'm Tom Power. More Q in a moment.
Think of your favorite one-hit wonder.
Or that overpriced toy your parents would never let you have.
Or that TV show that no one else remembers because it was canceled way too soon. Now what if we could fix it? I'm Francesca Ramsey.
And I'm DeLon Grant. And after 20 years of friendship, we are now hosting a new nostalgia podcast called Let Me Fix It.
Each episode, we'll dig into our favorite celebrities, shows, and brands of yesteryear, and then imagine what it would take to repackage them for relevance today.
Think of our show as an intervention, but with way less stakes.
So subscribe to Let Me Fix It wherever you get your favorite podcasts.
Can you imagine McCoy Tyner writing an opera?
Yeah.
Duke Ellington, Count Basie.
Yeah.
Thelonious Monk.
Yeah.
You know? Yeah. It's an inspiring thing for me to not shun away from what it is that I do in my jazz world in the orchestral world.
Like McCoy Tyner, like Thelonious Monk, like Duke Ellington, Terrence Blanchard is an incredible jazz musician, but one who is bringing a new sensibility and new stories to one of the oldest forms, opera. I'm Tom Power. You're listening to Q. So yeah, in terms of stories that haven't been told in opera before, let me tell you about the real life story behind Terrence's new opera. It's about a controversial welterweight world championship boxing match from 1962. We actually have like archival tape of it. Take a listen.
Introducing from the Virgin Islands and New York City, the challenger, Abel Griffith. Griffith, his opponent from Santa Clara, Cuba, the welterweight king, Benny Kid Perret. Perret, 15 rounds for the welterweight championship of the world.
So that's real archival tape of the match between, as you just heard, two boxers, Emil Griffith and Benny Perret. The story is, in the 12th round, Benny Perret took this barrage of punches. He ends up in a coma and dies 10 days later. And for Emil Griffith, he was haunted by that match for the rest of his life. And not just for the reasons you might think. Like, Terrence will tell you why this match was shrouded in controversy long before the bell even rang. Terrence Blanchard is a Grammy-winning jazz musician and composer. You might know him for his work scoring Spike Lee's movies. He decided to use that match and its aftermath as the backdrop to his first ever opera called Champion. And now Terrence is revisiting the opera in a new adaptation that's playing at the Met Opera in New York. So to talk about Champion, to talk about music, to talk about the infamous boxing match that it's based on, Terrence Blanchard joined me over Zoom from New York. Hi, how are you?
Hey, I'm good. How are you?
I'm good. I'm glad we found some time to catch you. I can only imagine things are pretty busy these days.
Just a tad.
How does it feel to have another opera at the Met?
Well, it's a bit overwhelming, to be honest. I mean, you know, I never saw this as being something happening in my career. Now that it's here, it's just been an amazing ride because I'm working with some of the best musicians in the world and some of the best talent in the world at putting on these productions. So I'm just taking it all in and just going for the ride.
Well, I'm going to get you to do a little bit of work for us here now. So as I mentioned, this is a reworking of an opera you wrote back in 2013. You originally performed at St. Louis. Mm-hmm. I didn't know this story until I started doing research for this interview. Can you tell us about this boxing match and sort of the background of it and the between Emil and Benny in 1962?
Well, you know, they both were welterweights, and they had fought twice before, and each one of them had won a fight. And just like anything else, you know, Benny Perret was trying to get a psychological edge over Emil. And at that time, you know, we didn't talk about people's sexuality in public. And he outed Emil at the press conference, you know, by calling him a very derogatory term for a gay male. And Emil was just upset, didn't know what was going on. He kept saying, why is he saying this? And the other part of it is that, you know, Benny Perret had just fought a guy by the name of Gene Fulmer. And Gene Fulmer was a very hard-hitting, heavy-hitting dude. And we think that Benny Perret was probably hurt going into this fight because it was just too much prior. And he actually tried to get out of the fight the night before because he kept saying his head was hurting, you know. But he gets into the fight. Emil's emotions get the best of him. The 12th round, you know, he knocks him out. And basically, Benny Perret never recovers. You know, Emil tried to go to the hospital to visit him. They wouldn't let him in. And years later, decades later, after that, you know, he meets up with Benny Perret Jr. And Benny Perret Jr. tells him, from the family, we don't harbor any ill will towards you. And you can just see 30 years of holding that hurt within inside himself just came rushing out of Emil. The other part of it is that, you know, him struggling with his sexuality, he said something where, and then this was the reason why I really wanted to do the opera. He said, I killed a man and the world forgave me, but I love the man and the world wants to kill me. And that's a very powerful sentiment.
Why did that stick with you?
Because it put it in perspective, you know, because here it is, you kill your best friend and everybody's okay with that. But you have a loving relationship with another man and people just can't really take that. There's just it just didn't seem to be any balance there for me. And I don't know. I thought about it, you know, the first time I won a Grammy, man, I turned to my wife and give her a kiss and go up on stage not without thinking about it. And this guy, you know, he becomes welterweight champion of the world and can't celebrate that openly with somebody that he loves.
You said that Benny's death did haunt Emil for a long time afterwards.
It did. I mean, in some of the fights that you saw after that fight, if any of his opponents backed up into the corner, he wouldn't go, because that's where, you know, he knocked Benny Perrette out in the corner. And it just seemed to be something that was just haunting him for the longest time.
How, you sort of touched on it there, but help me understand it better. How is this the topic for your first opera?
Well, I mean, I've been talking, you know, to some friends, my wife, and some people at Opera Theater St. Louis. They initially wanted me to do something on Hurricane Katrina, and I really didn't feel like that. It was too close for me at that point. I didn't want to touch on that topic. But my best friend is a heavyweight champion, and his name is Michael Bent.
Oh.
And he beat Tommy Morrison, you know, to take the title. And he was training me, because I've been boxing for over 20 years. And we got into a conversation about fighters, and he told me about Emil Griffith. And that story, it just stuck with me, you know. And when it came time to do the opera, I remembered that story and got everybody involved in thinking about it. And we all came up to the same agreement that it would make a great opera.
I want to play a clip from this new Met version of Champion Now. Just take a listen to this.
Get out the way, I got shit to forget. Get out the way, I got shit to forget. Who's gonna stop me now? Get out the way, who's gonna stop me? Who's gonna stop me now?
From the new Met Opera adaptation of Terrence Blanchard's Champion that is going to drive a fast car, Terrence Blanchard is my guest. As we said, you originally wrote the opera Champion in 2013. You're coming back to it again a decade later. How are you reflecting differently on this opera now?
Well, I'm unfortunately, I think the thing that makes it sad for me is that it's still an issue for some people, you know, and we should be past this. It's the way that I look at it. And the other thing that makes me proud about doing it, you know, there are a lot of gay and lesbian people in the production who are telling me, like, this is the first time that they feel like they could be themselves on the stage at the Met, you know, and that's a powerful thing, you know, because I feel for people who enter into an art form that doesn't love them the way that they love it, you know, and this production is allowing people to stretch their wings and just be themselves.
I mean, we're talking, you know, 40, 50, 60 years after this, and people are still coming up to you and saying, even at a place like the Met, and saying to you, I mean, this is the first time we've been able to be ourselves on stage. That must be meaningful to you.
It's very meaningful to me. I mean, because these are veteran performers. These are not people who just started in the world of opera. These are people who have been singing for 20 and 30 years.
How do you translate a story with a boxing match at the center into opera? Like, I know this might be hard, but what do audiences actually see? I mean, given that this is a radio show, can you tell me a little bit about the staging?
Yeah, well, I mean, here at the Met, we actually have a boxing ring, which is really cool. And we have an announcer, a boxing announcer, who speaks into a microphone and calls the entire opera like he's calling a fight. You know, we go round by round, and there are 10 rounds. And the ring itself is mobile. It moves back and forth. We have dancers who are amazing. Camille Brown is the choreographer, and she's choreographed some great, beautiful pieces, you know, for this production. We brought in Michael Bent to train the dancers with their boxing moves and the two principals, because what we do is when we get to the actual fight, we do like a freeze frame kind of thing with all of the punches with these guys, and they look pretty convincing.
You also got to work, I mean, this is a Canadian show, you also got to work with the great Canadian conductor Yannick Nézet-Séguin again on this. Can you tell me something about working with Yannick?
Man, Yannick is amazing. He's amazing because he gets it. He gets it right away. I mean, when we started having the first orchestra rehearsals, even for Fire back then when we did that.
This is your last opera you did at the Met, yeah.
I swear, I swear.
there would be moments I would get ready to say something and he would stop and he would already be talking to the orchestra. You know, it's one of those kind of things, man. And he's been really supportive of trying to bring new works to the Met, you know, and with these two operas that we've done, we've been successful in, like, you know, bringing things to the Met that people really enjoy experiencing, you know. And he's just a showman, you know. He shows up, he has a boxing hoodie on, and he comes out the second act with two boxing gloves on.
Really? You
know? Yeah. He's something else, man.
Oh, that's awesome. I mean, going back to what you were saying about stories that are, you know, being told. Yannick's efforts to get stories that maybe weren't told before in an opera context, you know, told. This is your second opera for the Met in New York. I read that an early teacher of yours, Roger Dickerson, said that orchestral music should be expanded through jazz and, quote, maybe you're the person to do that. So, like, how did you feel when that sort of placed on you? And do you feel like that's what you're doing through your work?
I do feel like that's what I'm doing. And what he meant by that was, you know, he just felt like the canon for jazz and in the orchestral world still has a lot to be, there's a lot that is still be defined. And with my experience of working in film and being a jazz musician, that I'd had a unique opportunity to kind of articulate those things for the orchestra. And that is what I've been trying to do, you know, with both of these productions. And it is a challenge, you know, because we're bringing these worlds together, and, you know, it's kind of like I won't say a new language, but it is a new experience for some people who didn't get a chance to ever really experience one or the other, whether it's the jazz band and experiencing playing with an orchestra or vice versa. But the thing that's interesting is that, you know, once they settle into the music, it's really starting to come together and everybody's really starting to understand what we've been doing.
Can you help me understand that better? The canon of jazz in the orchestral world has yet to be defined.
Yeah, I mean, one of the, you know, there's so many things that have been done with the language of jazz. There's still such a wide vocabulary to be experienced in the orchestral world. And I think that's what Roger was talking about when he was telling me these things. Harmonically, rhythmically, there are things that haven't really been touched on in that world. And it's an interesting proposition for me, because when I listen to Stravinsky, when I listen to Henri Dutilleur, you know, those composers really brought music that would challenge the canon for orchestral writing. And I think, you know, it's an inspiring thing for me to not shun away from what it is that I do in my jazz world, you know, in the orchestral world.
I understand a little bit better now. I mean, the idea that there would be different like parts of the language that orchestras have, I mean, given that I'm not an expert here, would have spoken in the jazz language. You know, there might have been a more swing based orchestra, or there might be sort of certain kind of eras historically of jazz that orchestras were able to access. But, you know, I guess what you're saying here is that there's so much more within the language of jazz, whether it be the tonality, whether it be the note choice, whether it be, I don't know, the
all of the things, harmonic progressions, everything. This is the way that I talk about it. You know, I listened to Highway One by William Grant Still. And then Tremonesia. I wanna sell to you this bag of luck. Your enemies it will keep away. Two great composers, two great operas, but never really put on the stage, right? And the thing that I think about is those guys were they were jazz musicians, you know? So if those guys' operas would have been produced on the stage, who knows what that could have inspired from other musicians? You know, can you imagine McCoy Tyner writing an opera?
Yeah.
Duke Ellington, Count
yeah.
Basie,
yeah.
Thelonious Monk,
yeah.
You know, yeah.
How are you? Like, what does writing an opera scratch something? Like, I know you're grateful to get to do it. But, like, does writing an opera give mm-hmm. you something that you don't get from your jazz work or your film work or your individual music work? Does writing an opera give you something specifically different?
Oh, definitely. I mean, opera is the highest form of musical theater you can experience. There's so many different things that come into play. When I'm playing with my band, I mean, we're starting to use visual things right now because that's just the way the world is going. But for the most part, it's really just about playing with the guys in the group. With this, man, you're telling a story. You have action. You have actors. You have a set with lighting and designs. There's so many things that come into play, you know, after you have great musicians and great singers performing your music. There's so many other things that have to fall into place. But when they do, there's a certain type of magic that happens with all of that stuff, you know, and that's the thing that keeps me excited about working in opera because, man, it's an amazing thing to sit in a room for 2 years to write these notes on paper and then all of a sudden see people with wardrobes, lighting, and set designs singing and moving around the stage performing this music.
Last time we talked, it was right before the premiere of Fire Shut Up in My Bones. And there was a lot of pressure on you, I feel, in that moment, whether you were feeling it or not. There was a lot of conversations mm-hmm. about whether that work was going to change the Met, was going to right historical wrongs, mm-hmm. I mean, or whether it was going to be successful at all. I mean, now we can say with a little bit of a distance that it was incredibly successful and it was incredibly meaningful. And mm-hmm. Is it a little bit easier this time? Are there things you learned from last time that are helping you?
No,
this
it's
time?
Not. It's not. No, it's not easy. No.
Oh no.
No. Because you know, because the thing is, you know, you don't want to be a one hit wonder, you know, and so even though I was very confident in all of the performance and what they were doing, I still didn't know how an audience was going to respond to it. You know, that's something that's always the X factor that you can't really predict. So, no, I was a nervous wreck going into the premiere. But, you know, once you get there and people respond to it, and then you can kind of breathe a sigh of relief after that. But prior to that, no, man, it's, you know, everything's up for grabs.
Well, before we go, last time we had you on, we took a moment to talk about your tribute album to Wayne Shorter. Mm-hmm. I mean, we lost Wayne in March, so sadly, and I know he was your friend
yes.
and mentor. Mm-hmm. A lot to be mm-hmm. said, and you and I talked about it last time, about sort of Wayne as a musician and the gifts he sort of gave us as a musician. What was he like mm-hmm. as a hang? Like, what was he like as a person?
He was one of the most beautiful spirits I've ever encountered in my life.
Really?
And he was a teacher because of that. He wasn't a teacher by sitting down espousing deep theories. No. Even though he did that in just normal conversation with Wayne, he was the teacher by example. He was a Buddhist who chanted every day. His spirit allowed him to walk freely amongst anybody, man. And I remember the story about when his wife died in the airplane crash, in the TWA airplane crash years ago. You know, Herbie told me that Wayne was consoling everybody else, you know. It's just the type of person he was. And even in his death, you know, the last words that he uttered were, "It's time for me to go get a new body to continue the mission."
Mm.
You know, he was just a special person, man. And he's truly going to be missed, that's for sure. I'm going to miss my interactions with him, the conversations that I've had with him, but I have those to cherish, you know, and we have all of the music here that he's left behind. So, I mean, he's in terms of his spirit and presence, he hasn't gone anywhere. It's just that physically I can't have those conversations with him anymore.
Well, I mean, maybe this is a good way to close things out. You know, Terrence, after most of the interviews on this show, we typically play a piece of music.
Why don't you, can you pick a Wayne Shorter mm-hmm. song for us to play?
Oh, it's spelled Diana, but they in Portuguese they say Gianna.
Tell me something about it before we hear it.
This particular composition of Wayne's just blows me away because it's typical Wayne. He was a master of creating beautiful melodies that are extremely singable, but harmonizing them in such a way where it takes you in unexpected places. And he was a master at that. And this tune, Gianna, doesn't have any improvisation. It's just, we're just playing the melody. But when you hear the melody and you hear how beautiful it's crafted, the way it develops and the way it evolves, you really get a sense of who Wayne Shorter was. When I heard that tune when I was in high school, it changed my life, you know, because it was just so, so gorgeous. You know, I kept thinking, how did he do that? How did he put this together?
Well, I'm so happy we get a chance to listen to it. And thanks for telling us about it. Thanks for telling us a little bit about Champion. Best of luck. And thanks again for coming on, Terrence.
Thanks for having me, man. It's always a pleasure talking to you.
Wayne Shorter, I mean, not just one of the most important jazz musicians really of all time, but this mentor to Terrence Blanchard. And it was, I will say, it's a real honor to get to talk to Terrence about Wayne and get him to pick a song. Like, really what you're hearing right now is a Wayne Shorter piece recommended by someone who knew him best. Terrence's reworking of his opera Champion about the tragic 1962 boxing match between Emile Griffith and Benny Perrette is on at the Metropolitan Opera in New York until May 13th. The great Canadian conductor Yannick Nézet-Séguin conducts it. Terrence will be in Canada for some dates with his E Collective later in the year. All right, that is it for the show today. Tomorrow, I'm taking a day off. So Talia Schlanger will be sitting in here guest hosting for you. Thanks so much, Talia, for sitting in while I lie on my couch and eat Fun Dip. Tomorrow on the show, Nina Manzor doesn't get bothered by expectations. In fact, she challenges them regularly, whether through her breakout sitcom We Are Lady Parts or her debut feature film Polite Society. She'll be here to talk to Talia about why battling perceptions of Muslim women in an entertaining way is so important. If you want to get in touch with the show, q@cbc.ca is the best way to do that. Don't tweet me. I'm not on Twitter. Drop me a line on Instagram. I'm at Tom Joe Power. The show is at cbcq. For some reason or other, I do check my DMs. We'll see you soon. Later on.
For more CBC podcasts, go to cbc.ca/podcasts.